It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us this morning. U.S. Olympics gymnastics superstar Simone Biles withdrew from the Tokyo Olympics. She cited the immense pressure she was under to perform and how it impacted her mental and physical performance, and was even worried about her own physical safety. And that's an experience many people can relate to, that feeling of stress and panic when you need to do something like speak publicly, perform, or more, even if it's something you've done 1,000 times. And our brains hold the key to learning more about this. We want to hear from you now. Is there a time when you faltered under pressure? Do you have stage fright or performance anxiety, and how do you handle it? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Vikram Chib is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and a research scientist at the Kennedy Krieger Institute. Vikram, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So what was your reaction when Simone Biles pulled out of the gymnastics team, you know, citing mental health concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, the stakes are really high, right? And those heightened stakes can really affect your performance. And I you mentioned that she said that she was worried about her safety and maybe not performing at an optimal level. Because of some anxiety and things like that. And I guess that could be thought of as a form of choking under pressure.
You know, Simone Biles is considered one of, if not the greatest gymnast of all time. And she went into Tokyo with these huge expectations for her to perform. And even though she typically is quite confident, that can still have an impact. How does that impact the brain?
Yeah, so we in my lab, we look at how different sorts of incentives impact skilled performance and when you're doing motor tasks or tasks that require physical coordination. Some of the incentives that we look at are financial incentives. We also look at social incentives. So you could think of the social incentive of, you know, being watched by people, or, you know, we're on the radio right now being listened to by a bunch of people. And that can sort of corrupt your motor performance. And what we know is that when you're being watched by others, for example, theory of mind regions are activated in the brain. So theory of mind is this idea of thinking about what other people are thinking about you. So you're thinking about other people, and that thinking about other people can, in some situations, it can motivate you actually. But in other cases, it can get you to choke under pressure. So there's sort of a sweet spot in which you want motivation and maybe anxiety-inducing motivation to be operating in. You want it to sort of push you to a point where you're at your peak performance, but not so much that you sort of fall over the edge and choke under pressure, right? And so when you think of the Olympics, right, the social incentives are immense, right? It's playing for your country, playing for the United States, not to mention the financial incentives, right? As Simone Biles, millions and millions of dollars in endorsement deals. So all of these things come together and sort of influence how you're motivated to do these different sports. And then that can lead you to choke under pressure when the incentives aren't just right, or you haven't tuned your behavior just right to accommodate for those motivations.
And because we are talking about how performance anxiety impacts the brain, this is a really complex issue. But can you break it down for us? Where in the brain is this happening?
So what we think is that an area of the brain called the ventral striatum, which is sort of deep in your brain and is responsible for rewards, is processing motivational factors. So what could happen is signals related to theory of mind, as I mentioned, thinking about what others are thinking, can filter into this area and influence how we perceive rewards. So maybe it makes rewards amplified. So it makes you feel like the rewards are at stake or even higher than they actually are, right? And the thing about the ventral striatum is there are neurons or cells in this area that process rewards, but they also process movement. Okay. And so this mixture of neurons, we think, could be interacting to give rise to performance. And in some case, that those reward signals motivate your performance, your movement performance in a good way, and get you to sort of amplify your behavior in a positive way. And then in other cases, it could get you to choke under pressure.
We're talking about how the brain and body perform under pressure with the Olympics underway. Vikram Chib is our guest. He's an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And Vikram, we're talking about how this kind of cross-firing happens in the brain. Is there an evolutionary theory as to why we might experience performance anxiety?
So I'm not sure if there's an evolutionary reason. So the one thing that we found is that how people perceive loss is very much related to this choking under pressure phenomenon. So people that tend to be more loss averse, that is, more worried about losing incentives that are offered to them, tend to choke under pressure more. I think choking under pressure is probably maladaptive, but what is interesting is that loss aversion is something that we see in a lot of different animals. So actually, monkeys, for example. So there is a woman, Laurie Santos at Yale, who's done studies where she sets up a token economy for monkeys, and she gets them to trade tokens for food, and shows that these monkeys are loss averse in the same way that humans are loss averse, right? And you can think about the idea of loss aversion evolutionarily as, like, if you lose in the wild, you die, you know? The idea of loss aversion makes sense. But I think actually choking under pressure is something that's sort of maladaptive, right? The other thing to realize is, for the most part, in our daily lives, in the world that we live in now, you know, we don't have the high stakes conditions that you do when you're in the wild searching for food and things like that.
Now, Vikram, is there a difference between, say, choking under pressure and having a mental block? I feel like some people who watch sports might hear about, like, the yips.
Yeah. I think choking under pressure is sort of a very, you know, loosely defined term. I think it's doing poorly or worse than you're expected to do, you know? And so that can take the form of physical performance, right? Which is what we're talking about related to the Olympics, but also can take the form of, mental choking under pressure, right? So for example, if, you know, you're taking a test, for example, and you've done all the studying, you know the concepts, but you just don't perform as well as you could, right? And that could be choking under pressure in mental tasks, but you also have choking under pressure in physical tasks. So both physical and cognitive skills, I think, can be influenced by choking under pressure. I will say that both of those types of tasks are motivated in the brain through similar circuitry. So the ventral striatum that I mentioned before is an area that is common to both mental and physical motivated tasks that comes online. So that sort of gives you sort of a common neural framework to think about motivation and how it could be influencing optimal performance and choking.
And Vikram, do we have a sense as to why maybe some people actually perform better under pressure than others?
So we think if the work from our lab suggests that maybe what's happening is those people that do better are better able to frame tasks in a way that makes them have less anxiety. So what we've done is we've looked at framing effects. So basically, you know, you could think of a good way to think about it is, like, I could tell you to do a task where you're playing to win. If you win, I'm going to give you $100, right? Another thing that has the same expected value, so the same potential for earnings, would be to endow you with $100 and tell you, I'm going to have you do this task, and if you fail, I'm going to take that $100 away from you, right? So in this case, you have the same level of reward available to you, right? It's just framed differently. And what we find is that people that frame the task that is appropriate for them, there's no one size fits all in the way to frame tasks. Instead, the way you frame a task is dependent on how you perceive the world. So people that are more loss averse, as I mentioned before, it seems a little bit counterintuitive, but those people that are more loss averse do better when they frame tasks as a potential loss. So that thing of endowing you with $100 and saying, look, you're playing to avoid losing $100. People that are less loss averse do better when you say to them, hey, you're playing to win $100. So we think framing is a good way to overcome choking under pressure. And actually, I think that people that do better under pressure might understand a little bit better how they need to frame things to get the results they need and to be motivated in the optimal way for them.
We are talking about how the brain and body perform under pressure as the Olympics are underway, especially in light of U.S. gymnastics superstar Simone Biles withdrawing from the games. Our guest is Vikram Chib. He's an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And we'll continue this conversation in a moment and take your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking about what happens in the brain when we experience stage fright or performance anxiety, especially with the Olympic Games underway right now. Our guest is Vikram Chib, Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Now, are you a person that performs better under pressure, or do you perform better when there's not so much pressure? Have you had performance anxiety before? How did you overcome it, or how are you still working on it? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, Vikram, before we went to the break, you were talking about reframing how we approach. If you're loss adverse, if you frame it as you're going to lose something, you perform maybe a little bit better. Or if you want to win, if you frame it as a win, then you might do it a little bit better. For people who might be a little on the fence about that, how can they maybe incorporate either of those frames to overcome some performance anxiety?
So I think one of the easy, so the idea of this loss framing, you sort of need to know how loss averse you are. But an easier framing technique, I think, that people can use sort of in their daily lives is, rather than thinking about events as a single instance, think about sort of the portfolio of all of the high stakes things that they do. So, for example, if I'm doing a radio interview, for example, I might think to myself, rather than saying, "Oh my gosh, this is the one radio interview I have to do. I really got to focus on doing really well on this interview. I'm very nervous about it, but I got to do well," right? So like, I'm actually giving myself anxiety doing that right now. So rather than doing that, you think to yourself, well, you know, I've done a couple radio interviews before. There'll be radio interviews before this. There have been radio interviews before this. There will be radio interviews after this. And I'll do well, right? And that sort of then makes you less myopic about your performance and actually lowers your anxiety level. This is actually a strategy that traders are, financial traders are often told to do to sort of reduce their loss aversion. They're told to not think about the single financial decision they're making related to investing, but actually think about the portfolio of investments that they're going to make, right? And so that they're not myopic about the choice that they're going to make and maybe perseverate on it, which leads to anxiety, which leads into some suboptimal decision-making or performance, but rather think about sort of the whole portfolio of decisions or tasks that they're going to do, you know?
That's some good advice for not only guests, but also for some hosts as well. So thank you for that, Vikram. And I want to get back to something you were talking about a little bit earlier, which was the social aspect of performance. You know, the Olympics this year have few or no audience members. And the Olympics is a spectacle. Like tens of thousands of people go there and the athletes are expecting it. How does having a physical audience affect performance?
So so having a physical audience, I think, affects performance. You know, for you and I, say if we were doing athletics or something that we're maybe so-so at, I think a physical audience can have a big impact, right? It can, as we talked about before, you know, you're mentalizing about what the audience is thinking about you, and that can drive you to do better in certain situations. Maybe if the audience is really big, it could over-motivate you and get you to choke under pressure. But I think for the athletes that are sort of at the top of their game, the audience, you know, the lack of an audience might not have as big of an impact because they're so tuned in to their mind and their body and how they're doing. Now, I think where you might see a difference, and what I'm interested in seeing, is there going to be a difference in the number of personal bests that people make or world records, for example. So maybe not having that audience there and not having people in the stands is going to reduce the amount of those sort of world record performances or personal bests. I think we always see, you know, year after year that, you know, people always hit their personal best at the Olympics, or they, you know, that we see all these world records at the Olympics. And it, you know, it's one theory is that it's because, you know, everybody, you know, it's this world event and everybody's cheering for each other and getting all the athletes very motivated and amped up. But with that not there, I suspect that you might see less personal bests and less world records.
We are talking about how the brain and body perform under pressure as the Olympics are underway. Vikram Chib is our guest, and he's an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Now, one thing about the Olympics compared to some other professional sports is that athletes of all ages compete. You have some athletes as young as 13, in some cases, and some as old as 40. How do different ages and different brain development stages impact performance?
That's a really good question. So we know, and I don't know for certain. I'll tell you what we do know about reward processing. So there are differences in prefrontal cortex and striatum related to development. So, I mean, when you're a teenager, you know, those things aren't as developed. I think you're probably thinking about those women's skateboarders that were like 13 years old, which is amazing. And so there are differences in how those reward regions are developed. We have not actually looked at choking under pressure as a function of age yet. So I'm not completely sure actually how that would work, but we do know that there are differences in these reward areas, which could lead to some differences in choking under pressure and sort of the neural mechanisms responsible for it in younger people.
As someone who studies the brain and that you've looked at some of these reward mechanisms and all of that, what are some of the other things that you might be looking towards moving in the future as part of your research?
Yeah. So, we're really interested in these social aspects. So we're just beginning to look at how audience pressure influences performance. We're also interested in competition. So there's not, you know, it's not just that you're being watched, right? You're competing against other people, right? And that's a social thing as well, right? How you interact with your opponent. So another thing that we're really interested in the lab is looking at sort of the social interactions that people make in competitive environments and how the brain comes online when those things are happening. And we still don't know how that happens. And so hopefully we'll find out sometime soon.
We're talking to Vikram Chib right now of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And, you know, what will you be watching for? You mentioned a little bit about personal bests, but what will you be watching for with the Olympics moving forward?
The personal bests and world records is what I'm really interested in, sort of looking back at the old data that we have to look at personal bests and world records, seeing where they were in previous Olympics and where they are in the future. I also must say, I'm curious if you know if the women's soccer team has won or not, because they're playing the Netherlands right now. I think I'm most interested in that sort of whether people will be hitting their optimal performance at this Olympics, like we've seen in so many Olympics in the past, and then trying to infer whether that's related to the social aspects that are different.
Thank you, Vikram. Vikram Chib is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He joined us to talk about performance anxiety and the brain. Coming up, we will get the latest Wisconsin news. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Now we're doing a roundup of Wisconsin news, including an update on what's happening with the head of the State Board of Natural Resources, the status of the ancestral land of Fond du Lac, of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and more. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the dust-up with the Natural Resources Board? How would you like the Attorney General's office to handle the NRB? Call in with your questions now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Danielle Kading is our WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, so let's start with the Natural Resources Board. The chair of the state NRB remains in the position despite his six-year term expiring in May. What's the story there?
Yeah, so basically his term expired in May, as you said, and there are six-year terms that are set under statutes, and the current chair, Fred Prain, decided that he wasn't going to step down to make way for Governor Tony Evers' appointees. Governor Tony Evers named appointees to the board at the end of April. He named Ashland School Teacher Sandy Nas and Milwaukee real estate developer Sharon Adams to the board, but Prain was the only one to not step down and decided that he wanted to continue his presence because he felt there were a number of issues coming up that could use his leadership on the board. And he cited water issues and issues with nitrate and wolf management among those.
Can you talk a little bit about Dr. Fred Prain's background that leads him to believe and say that he deserves to stay on the board?
Yeah, well, he's argued that, you know, this is nothing new. This is something that has been done in the past, although it is kind of unusual. We've seen this, I think, only two times before in the last couple decades where there have been members of the Natural Resources Board that have decided not to step down and remain on the board. And it's becoming an issue because it's a little bit of a political power struggle that we're seeing on this board as they're taking up some significant natural resources policy issues coming up here in the next month's meeting, one of them being setting a harvest for the upcoming wolf hunt. They're going to decide on a quota. And so that has sparked concern from a number of groups and the Humane Society of the United States and the Center for Biological Diversity sent a letter to the Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call last week, you know, asking him to step in and take action to review Prain's legal status on the board and whether or not he should be removed before our next month's meeting.
Now, the question is, how much does it matter that he remains in the position?
Well, we've seen in the past, in past meetings of the Natural Resources Board, that there's been a pretty even split. It's been basically 4-3 on decisions that they've made regarding wolf issues that have come before the board. I think there's the belief out there that if this Ashland school teacher Sandy Naz were on the board, she's an Evers appointee, and they think that maybe she would be more favorable for conservation of wolves and wolf management in Wisconsin, because we've heard the Natural Resources Board, Fred Prain, say in past meetings things like he expressed fears in January when they held a special meeting that they were going to lose the ability to manage the wolf population at the state level because of concerns over lawsuits that have been filed by environmental and wildlife groups seeking to restore protections of the wolves. He has also said that he believes that there's a lot of wolves on the landscape and is kind of drawn into question whether or not the DNR was going to use its current existing wolf management plan as a guideline for setting any wolf harvest quota for an upcoming wolf season. And critics of that plan point out that it is vastly outdated. It was first written in 1999 and last updated in 2007. So there's some concern that he could be a deciding vote on what might happen with this upcoming wolf harvest quota.
Now, how could Dr. Prain be removed from this position?
Well, he could be removed if the attorney general decides to bring a legal action against him on behalf of the state. Basically, he would take this special form of legal action to review whether or not he's legally sitting on the board. And Prain believes that he is because of a prior Supreme Court ruling that allows office holders to hold over in their position. But there's been debate among some of these groups that actually the law says it's a 6-year term. It's not a 6-year term. And whenever the Senate confirms your replacement. So we could see the attorney general possibly bring an action on behalf of the state to have the courts decide whether or not he should be removed.
We are talking with WPR reporter Danielle Kading right now about recent Wisconsin news. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Now, Danny, you've been following a Lake Superior tribe's push to get land returned to them, and that's been getting some traction. Can you tell us a little bit more about that story?
Yeah, so there's a remote strip of land offshore from Lake Superior, and it represents the ancestral home of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And research has shown that, you know, the tribe's ancestors may have settled there as early as 400 years ago. But what happened was more than a century ago, tribal members, both those who were still living and those who had passed on, were removed from that area, which is known as Wisconsin Point. And in 1918, nearly 200 Ojibwe graves were removed from the burial grounds there to make way for U.S. Steel's plans for ore docks that were unfortunately never built. So these people were uprooted. Their ancestors were removed and reburied somewhere else off-site for a project that never happened. And it's said that, you know, at least 7 generations were laid to rest at the Wisconsin Point Cemetery, including the community's leader, Chief Joseph Osagi. And so now there's a new effort underway to return those burial lands to the tribe and also the reburial site in Superior. And the Superior City Council recently passed a resolution in support of returning those lands to the tribe. And those lands would be placed in federal trust for the tribe to oversee.
Do we have a timeline? It feels like this is still in process, but do we know when this might happen?
No, I don't think so. It sounds like it's a pretty lengthy process. You know, right now, the Fond du Lac Band and Superior City Councilor Jenny Van Sickle, she's really been spearheading a lot of the effort on this, and they plan to ask the Wisconsin Burial Sites Preservation Board to provide an official letter of recommendation to transfer both of these sites to the Fond du Lac tribe at a meeting in September. They're also working with Democratic Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin's office to prepare a petition for the transfer of these lands that they would then forward to the Interior Department. And as you may or may not know, you know, the Interior Department Secretary is now Deb Haaland, and she became the nation's first Native American Cabinet Secretary earlier this year. So it sounds like it could be quite a while yet before this process gets going. And there have been efforts in the past to return these lands here, in particular with the Lake Superior tribe, back to Fond du Lac.
We are talking to Danielle Kading right now. She's a reporter for WPR based in Superior, and we're getting a roundup of all the Wisconsin news that came that we're just paying attention to, might have flown under the radar. We will continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're taking a deep dive into all the Wisconsin news you might have missed, including the upcoming end of the federal eviction moratorium and how climate change is impacting land along the coast of the Great Lakes. Our guest right now is Danielle Kading. She's WPR's reporter based in Superior. Now, what questions do you have about the end of the federal moratorium on evictions? What do you think should be done about erosion along the Great Lakes? And if you have property along the Great Lakes, how are you and your family handling that erosion? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Danny, the federal eviction moratorium is set to expire. How might that affect people across Wisconsin?
Well, there's a lot of concern that, you know, we're going to see evictions spike as the federal ban on the eviction moratorium expires at the end of this week. You know, it's been extended several times during the coronavirus pandemic because of fears that maybe state and local governments weren't prepared to handle the demand from those who might need assistance. And, you know, I believe it was just yesterday where President Joe Biden said that he would have liked to extend that federal eviction moratorium because of the spread of the Delta variant that we're seeing right now with coronavirus. But he said basically that his hands are tied after the Supreme Court signaled that the moratorium should end, and that they're not really going to allow any continuations on that federal ban unless Congress were to show clearly that, you know, they could do that. And so basically President Biden has called on Congress to extend this moratorium. It's unclear whether that's going to happen. And if it isn't extended, then there's fear that, you know, thousands of people could be forced out of their homes as they're still struggling to, you know, make rent or pay their bills because maybe they haven't received either emergency rental assistance or they've been struggling during the pandemic with work or haven't received unemployment benefits. You know, there's a variety of reasons that people might be facing a housing crisis right now.
Danny, insofar as you know, what have we heard from any of the members of our Wisconsin congressional delegation about this?
You know, I cannot speak to that. I apologize. I'm not aware of where they stand on it. I know that Democrats in the House are hoping to that I believe they have introduced a bill to extend that moratorium, but it's unclear whether or not that would be pushed through.
Now, this federal evictions moratorium has been in place since not the beginning of the pandemic, but certainly since last summer. What have we seen in Wisconsin in terms of how renters have handled the lack of evictions, but also maybe how landlords have tackled it as well?
Well, we've seen that more than 12,000 households have, you know, reached out for this emergency assistance that's been made available through the Wisconsin Emergency Rental Assistance Program. You know, Governor Tony Evers announced $322 million in funding through that program, which was provided through federal coronavirus relief. So far, the state's awarded around $44 million of that to people who need help to remain in their homes. But there's a lot of fear moving forward because, I talked with the Tenant Resource Center in Madison, and August is typically their busiest month for eviction cases because it's a college town. And they normally see almost 100 eviction cases each week. And so now there's fears that that will be even higher as people are receiving eviction notices with the end of this upcoming moratorium. Some of the things that they're seeing as a result of the pandemic, typically their largest, the people who need the most help are female-headed Black households in the Madison area. But they've also seen a lot of more Latinx households who are coming in looking for assistance, probably due to the loss of jobs, service jobs, people working in the restaurant industry, which has really been most impacted during all of the shutdowns that we've seen in light of coronavirus. And so there's basically everywhere you go in the state, there are impacts, the level of which and the magnitude of which is different for each region.
And Danny, what protections or assistance would remain after the moratorium expires to help people avoid being evicted?
Well, obviously, this rental program is one of them. So people can reach out to the state and apply for this emergency rental assistance. You know, one of the fears is that people might not even know that they're eligible to receive this. And so basically, if you are at risk of being evicted and you make less than 80% of your county's median income, you are eligible to receive this state rental assistance if you're struggling financially because of the pandemic. And you can receive up to 15 months of assistance with current or unpaid rent and utility bills. So that's one thing. Another thing that people might want to consider, if you're getting an eviction notice, reach out to a housing attorney and see what your options are. I believe that some people have advised tenants who are at risk that you should document everything that you do. Talk to your landlords, reach out to your landlords and see if you can work something out. And I think a lot of landlords are working with tenants to connect them to emergency rental assistance that is available.
We are talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading right now about recent Wisconsin news. Join in with your questions right now at 800-642-1234. We're going to be talking about, erosion along the Great Lakes. Now, Danny, a recent survey found that, Great Lakes mayors expect to spend about $245 million over the next 5 years on repairs because of coastal damage from climate change. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of damage that we are expecting to see?
Yeah, well, in some cases, we've already seen it, right? I mean, there's about $86 million that these Great Lakes communities have seen in the last 2 years where they're already spending that money because they've seen damage from erosion, damage from flooding, damage to ports and marinas. It's pretty extensive as we've seen this surge in Great Lakes lake levels over the past several years. I mean, they've surged to record highs, especially on Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. These lakes, they typically fluctuate between swings in high and low water levels. And that's all driven by changing temperatures, rain, snow, evaporation rates. And researchers have said that these lakes are seeing the strongest swings during changes in precipitation and evaporation. So while we're seeing the levels ease a bit this year, they're still expected to be above their long-term average. And I think the only Great Lake that they're not seeing that right now is Lake Ontario. So, as they've seen these swings between high and low levels on lakes, it's the high levels that are really damaging for these lakeshore communities where they're eroding coastlines, taking beaches away, affecting buildings and infrastructures and parks and beaches. And so it's just pretty extensive. And they're hoping to see some funding through the federal infrastructure bill to help address some of these infrastructure problems that they're seeing along lakeshore communities.
And as you mentioned, these lakeshore communities are, if not used to, you know, erosion, flooding, et cetera, they're certainly still working on addressing the issues. What kind of ways have communities tried to reduce coastal damage from climate change?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that communities have been doing all along Lake Superior and Lake Michigan to try and be more resilient in the face of these rising water levels. In some places, we're seeing cities that are moving infrastructure further inland, where they're actually moving roads further inland to stabilize and working also to stabilize shoreline and creating dunes or wetlands and cobblestone beaches where there might currently be infrastructure. We've seen armoring of shorelines where people are putting in large stones or rock or concrete. That really picked up last year along Lake Michigan as they almost reached, they did reach record highs, but almost an all-time record high. And so, you know, other proactive steps that people are taking in their communities along these shorelines are, you know, trying to move stormwater away from bluffs that may be at risk of erosion, or building buildings further back from bluffs along these shorelines to keep development away from high water. Because I think we've all seen on the news these pictures of homes on, particularly it seems like in Michigan, but even, you know, in southern Wisconsin, where we've seen homes falling into Lake Michigan. So it's an issue everywhere, and there are steps that people can take. You know, I believe the Wisconsin Coastal Management Program has funded a coastal resilience project in southeastern Wisconsin to help communities identify hazards along their coastline. They've provided a self-assessment tool to help them identify areas that may be vulnerable to erosion or to flooding and things like that. So there are a lot of actions being taken by communities, but, you know, some of these things are really costly. Like if we have to, you know, repair infrastructure or build new infrastructure to withstand some of the impacts that we're seeing from climate change, then that all costs money. And so I think they're estimating that across the entire Great Lakes region, it's going to cost around $2 billion to repair some of these impacts over the next 5 years. So, again, they're looking for that money in the federal infrastructure bill.
Yeah, and that's my follow-up question is, who's now on the hook for that $2 billion?
So it would obviously be paid for by the taxpayers. And so I guess that's a cost-benefit analysis that people are going to have to take. You know, is it worth it to spend the money up front to keep your communities from dealing with the damage that we might see in the future, or the damage that, frankly, we're seeing now? You know, I believe Governor Tony Evers, in a visit to Saxon Harbor on Lake Superior, said in June that just in, I think, northern Wisconsin alone, they'd seen $100 million in damage from flooding. So these costs are adding up, and I think we need to be thinking about what it's going to take to avoid even more costly expenses in the future. And that might require some upfront investment.
Danny, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Danielle Kading is our WPR reporter based in Superior. She joined us to give us a roundup of Wisconsin news. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.